welcome to the show. This is TED Talks Too Much. And we've got another great one for you today. I am Ted Moss, ex-paperboy, stand-up comedian, and your host. We are located in the OK Boomer Studios just outside of Flint, Michigan. That's right, Flint. Michigan's water wonderland, where they are still wondering when they'll get some clean water. But while we all wait for that to happen, let's talk. And today we got a real treat. We have Mr. Billy Ray Bauer, a 30-year veteran of stand-up comedy, and one of the few people I know doing stand-up that's almost as old as I am. He will fool you with his good old boy charm, but really he's one of the best in the business, well-spoken and brilliant. So if you want to know about stand-up, stay tuned. We are looking for a few good men. That's right, men. And boy, oh boy, oh boy, are there some perky perks. Have you ever thought a man's rectory is a place you want to be? Have you ever seen people rise when a bride in a long white dress passes by and think, I want to be her? If dirty stories are your thing, better than Penthouse Forum, we've got a quorum. And they're lined up to tell you true stories in person. That's right. You could be the professional in the confessional, where you can listen and no one can see your hands. Just contact us at Holy Joe's Super Seminary, where you never lose your job because we specialize in transferring trouble. Or just go to surroundmewithboysanddresses.com, where you can apply today.
How's everybody doing? That's good to hear. Looking for my follically challenged friends in this crowd. Thank you, sir. I appreciate it. It's tough to be bald, you know? Gets hot like this, you start sweating. You realize your eyebrows, your last line of defense. If it keeps on raining, the levee's gonna break.
And that, my friends, is Mr. Billy Ray Bauer. I had the pleasure of spending the afternoon with Billy Ray. Played a round of golf, then we shot the shit for about 3.5 hours. We talked about the role of comedy in society, different styles of different stand-up comedians, a little bit about great parents and parents that weren't so great. But if you're a fan of comedy, you're going to really enjoy this. So let's give OK Boomer Studio welcome to Mr. Billy Ray Bauer.
And they were saying, you're going to cut that one out, right? That'll be cut out. And of course, it never did get cut out. So
really?
Yeah, because Jerry has a bit of a problem with political correctness. You may have seen it. They posted it on social media a few times, his comments. Because even though...
Can we record this for the show?
Yeah, sure.
All right.
Yeah, you can record anything you want.
Okay, well, because it's recording. I just didn't know if you want me to cut that out.
So. No, I'm not going to say anything controversial or that could result in a legal...
Okay, well, let's start at the beginning then.
All right.
Billy, welcome to the show. How you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good, man.
I've just spent the last 4 hours with you, and I'm still asking how you're doing. So
I know. Well, that when you get to be our age, it's a good idea to ask often.
To check back in.
That's right.
Yeah.
Because I'm not wearing my, what is that, the medic alert necklace? So I don't have it on right now, so I'm kind of exposed.
Well, I know. So if you go down, what do I do, man? Do I just leave you, or... Is there somebody I should call? You want to tell me about?
Yeah, there's a few people in my address book you could call, you know, because okay. They're probably fun to talk to.
Yeah.
You know, but as far as getting me help, I don't think any of the people in my address book would be of any.
Well, hold on. Let's get back to Jerry Seinfeld. You were saying something interesting about Jerry Seinfeld.
Well, just that, you know, watching his show, The Comedians in Cars Getting Coffee, and it was an episode, and I thought it was the Eddie Murphy episode, but I could be wrong. But they're in the car heading out to get the coffee, and they somehow there's a joke that involves Asian people, and he was trying to make the distinction between Koreans and Japanese and Chinese, and then it came off kind of sounding like it was not
good, huh?
Well, not politically correct, but as we were talking about the idea, and Jerry Seinfeld, of all people, whose act is fairly uncontroversial and doesn't really go in any of those directions, he's really railed against that idea of political correctness because it does tend to create a problem for comedy, because comedy is so much in the moment and so much the thoughts that you have, that we all have, it's commonality. And unfortunately, or fortunately, however you view it, bias and stereotypes, prejudices, and all those other things are still part of the humor. I mean,
right.
You know, I'm not a fan of racial humor. You know, you've had this happen. I'm sure you do a show and some drunken idiot will come up to you and want to tell you a joke, and it's invariably not funny and racist.
Yeah, here's one you can use
in your show.
Like, yeah.
Here's one you can use in one of your skits.
Actually, they pay me to be funny. I'm not going to use your joke. Yeah.
Here's one you can do in one of them their skits you're doing. So, you know, you get that kind of a joke. And, of course, you're not going to tell those jokes. But at the same time, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood that was Italian, German, and Polish. So there were Italian jokes, there were Polish jokes, and a few German jokes tossed
in. Yeah, and everybody got that they were jokes.
Yeah, they were just jokes. You know, they were jokes. They weren't... It's just... I think we all have to develop a sense of comfort even when somebody veers off perhaps a little bit. I don't...
Well, it's our job to veer off if we're doing comedy, isn't it? Our job to say something that's an unspoken truth that resonates with people, like, yeah, I kind of get it. I kind of think about that too, but it's kind of politically incorrect to say that. Like the jester used to do at the court of the king. Because he was dressed up like a jester, he could make fun of what the king was wearing.
Well, he was the original comedian speaking truth to power.
Right.
Which is the other idea here. It isn't even just about political correctness. It's about, you know, the idea like George Carlin or Lenny Bruce or Mark Twain or even Will Rogers.
Right.
These are people who stand out not just as comedians. Dave Chappelle actually falls into this category, I think, pretty nicely as well. They transcend the idea of just making an audience laugh. They also have invested the audience in learning something. There's something to be learned, whether it's political or philosophical. There's some truth there that they're going to impart to an audience that goes beyond just being a comedian. That's why George Carlin in particular is so revered by people of my generation. You know,
right.
He was a big influence.
Yeah.
Because he didn't just speak truth to power. He was just funny on so many levels. He had jokes that, some of my favorite Carlin jokes are not controversial jokes. The seven words don't interest me as much as the 23 odds and ends you have on a table. 22 of them fall off. What do you have left? An odd or an end? That to me is a much more profound and something to consider.
Yes. Well, he was great, but we're losing that, aren't we? I mean, can you think of anybody other than Chappelle that currently is speaking those truths? Or are we in a situation now where you can't actually do that?
Well, you know, I think that there's always been a problem for comedians like myself. I would certainly be included in what we would call the anonymous community of comedians. That is to say, we don't necessarily put butts in the seats.
Right.
If they come to a nice comedy club and we're performing there, they're going to get a great show, but they probably don't know a whole lot about us.
Right.
You know, I'm not Ron White. I'm not Lewis Black. I'm not Jerry Seinfeld or Jim Gaffigan or any of these guys who are filling up theaters. And those people have the luxury of having an audience come to see them that already knows what they're about.
Yeah.
There ain't nobody showing up at a Chappelle show.
It doesn't understand what his voice is going to be.
Yeah, where he's going to go.
Yeah.
And that you know, you're going to hear some things that might, you know, I mean, he did a great thing about bullying in that last special.
Right.
That was absolutely priceless.
Yes.
And again.
So you can get away with more if you have an audience that understands who you are.
Yeah.
And kind of a track record with them.
I think there's no question about that. And I think that's a very freeing part of being a comedian when you get to the point where people come out. I mean, you know, we were talking earlier, you know, working with Dave Coulier.
Right.
Here's a guy who's not controversial, who's a very amusing guy, does a lot of impressions, very laid back. But people know him because of Full House. And so they have an idea of what they're going to get. Now, conversely, people go to see Bob Saget.
Yeah, exactly. And I've heard that. Yeah,
they brought their kids, and they're like, "Oh my God, what did he just say?" And that's the problem with the publicity machine, because Saget gained great popularity with Full House, but that really wasn't what he was all about.
I remember when I saw him on Entourage for the first time, I thought, well, this is different.
Well, yeah, and I knew him, you know, because of being a comedian. I knew of him prior to Full House.
Right.
And I knew his act. His act previously wasn't so much blue or dirty or adult back in the day, but he always did tons of crowd work.
Oh.
He was very good. I mean, I've seen him do a set, I think it was at the Improv, where it was almost entirely crowd work.
And really?
He was very good at it, too. So, wow. You know, and crowd work is, and it's interesting, because when you're talking about stand-up comedy, it's easy to lump us all together, but there's really a lot of subcategories. You know, we have guitar comics.
Yeah.
We've got prop comics. We've got observational humorists. We've got ranters.
Uh-huh.
We've got storytellers. We've got a younger generation that I think the term that is popular right now is stream of consciousness.
Yeah.
Comics where it isn't a setup and a punchline. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I'm not a fan.
No, that's not me. Of course, if you see me, I'm a bit of a throwback in a sense, too, because I do a lot of things in my show. I have a whole part of my show which is devoted to growing up in the city of Detroit that's a reminisce, that is a nostalgia thing. And it's about commonality.
Right.
Everybody,
I've seen it.
People come up to me always and say, oh, when you did that bit about calling out your friends.
Yeah.
Or the milk chute.
I know.
Or the, you know, the box that the refrigerator came in and
exactly.
All of those things.
Yeah.
Those are things that are universally accepted. But I also do a lot of stuff that isn't necessarily going to fall into that category. I mean, I got stuff that I do that's observational. You know, I do a lot of stuff about relationships because I've been married to the same woman.
But really, do you consider yourself a storyteller by trade?
No, I consider myself that I go back to, you know, I would go back to like guys like Billy Crystal, who could do a few impressions in their show, but they weren't an impressionist. They could do some dialects in certain material, but they weren't a dialectician. Yeah. They do some observational humor, but they aren't necessarily an observational type comic.
Right.
Because you have to look at your influences. For me, it's Carlin. And, of course, I was Bill Cosby, one of the more disappointing things to happen in the comedy world, as far as I'm concerned. He was looked up to by tons of guys in our age group. You know, I'm 63, and I grew up on those.
I remember when his albums came out.
Wonderfulness,
like the first,
and Why Is There Air, and My Brother Russell, and all these great albums. And they were wonderful albums, but then what happened with him, of course, he got caught up in his own importance or feeling of self-importance. I mean, that interview that Seinfeld did with Eddie Murphy, Eddie talked about how Bill Cosby was very unkind to him because Cosby felt that he should be working clean and shouldn't be doing
He used to call
material.
People up and correct
and
them.
And harass them and things. Yeah. And then, of course, turns around and turns out that this guy was a monster, was a predator.
Yeah. When I was out in Lake Tahoe one time skiing, I ran into a really beautiful young girl. And I'm significantly younger than Cosby, and she was significantly younger than me. And she told me that Cosby used to come by and pick her up sometimes. I said, what do you mean? She said, well, he'd pick me up in his car, and we'd go places. I thought, well, that's kind of strange. She said, yeah, we're just kind of friends. I'm thinking, yeah, right.
Sure you are. Sure.
Yeah. Have another Quaalude.
Sitting in daddy's lap, are you?
Yeah, it's sad. It really is sad because he was kind of the standard bearer for so many years.
Well, yeah, because he was the, you know, unlike Carlin and Richard Pryor, who were the other really guys that were in his league, you know, he was the clean.
Yeah, he was a clean Red Fox.
Yeah.
He was really funny and he was clean.
And it was reinforced not just by his albums. Then, of course, afterwards you have the TV show,
sure,
the Cosby
the
Kids,
and the
Cosby Show, and all of that, you know, all kind of built up that persona that he, you know, the real him was hidden from the public.
Well, he just had a little kink down below that he couldn't shake, you know.
Well, yeah, you look at Louis C.K., another guy who, for the life of me, I can't figure out exactly what was going on in his head. I really don't get it.
The weird thing about Louis is that he asked permission, though. And I think that's weird that you bring people in and say, is it okay if I do this? And people go, yeah, go ahead. And they go, oh, didn't like that so much. The whole thing is weird to me. It's kind of like the Al Franken thing. Really? You're like, you know, I'm like, I, you know, he was making a joke. If he took the picture and showed it to her, it'd be funny. Did he put it out without her permission? He wasn't doing it. The thing that made it funny is it was inappropriate. Look at, you know, I was thinking about attacking you while you're asleep. Oh, you're a weirdo. You shouldn't do that. But he's no longer a senator, for God's sake. Good God. What a fall from grace over one stupid photo.
Yeah.
And it's really a shame you can't make one mistake in this day of, you know, social media and everybody knows everything about everything. Yeah.
Well, that was at that time when the shit hit the fan. That's when the Me Too movement really took hold.
Well, and back in the good old days, you had to save your blue dress with the stains on it.
You know,
and with your Lewinsky
stuff. But you're going to lose some people like Al Franken, along with really, truly predatory people like Harvey Weinstein.
Yes, exactly.
You know, you got to look at it that way. That's going to happen. The inevitability is going to happen. When the pendulum swung and all of a sudden this behavior that had been acceptable for so long was no longer acceptable behavior, then it was going to take out some casualties.
Yeah, but that pendulum has swung so hard. Well, it's scary. But do I have to have a contract? If I go out with a new girl, do I have to have a contract with her?
Oh, I would.
Before I do anything.
Sign waivers. It's as simple as that. You're going to need to sign in three places. I need your signature at the bottom, but I also need your initials up here.
Yeah, exactly. Well, who was it that said, you know, first time through, that's just an invitation. It's not harassment. If you say no and I do it again, that's harassment. First time through, I'm just testing the waters.
Well,
I'm just trying to see, is this okay? I have never stopped with a woman and said, would it be okay now if I did this? You just kind of move into doing that. Yeah. And they got elbows and things, and they can give you signals so you don't fight the signals. I don't even know if you can do that anymore.
Well, the bigger problem here, it is, you know, the problem is it's made its way into the mainstream consciousness regarding men in general, when in fact the real problem here is about predatory situations.
Right.
It isn't you going on a date with another person when you're on equal ground. We're talking about in a business sense or a business situation.
Yeah.
Because that's the problem with what happened with Louis C.K. is while you were at a comedy club performing as a comedian and you had an opening act there with you, whether you were in the club or at the condo or in the hotel or whatever,
right,
you're still technically employed as a comedian to do this. And that is a job and that is a business situation. And if you're the headliner and you've got a young, impressionable comedian, a young lady who's trying to get somewhere.
It was that why the girls were connecting with him, not that they were groupies, more that they were trying
They were working with him. These weren't just girls from the audience.
Right?
No, these were opening acts.
Oh, really?
That's the problem.
Yeah.
Because his position as the headliner, just the headliner, as a very, very well-known, and at the time, he was probably one of the top two or three comedians in the country in terms of his popularity.
Right. But doing filthy jokes.
Well, he always did. He's always been very, it cost him his marriage. I mean, the things he said about his wife.
Yeah.
I mean, they were funny as hell, but I mean, would you want to be his wife having been talked about like that?
No.
That's why I've been married for 40 years because
why you work clean.
But there is a bit of a fallacy. I don't always work clean. I have a joke in my show that I don't always do.
Right.
That I talk about my wife and I say, people ask me, when they hear that I've been married for 40 years, they say, what is the secret? What is it? And I go, the fact that she's been in a coma for the last 19 years has really helped keep the thing going, because when it comes to sex, she doesn't say no anymore. You know, she just kind of gurgles.
Yeah.
It's pretty.
I had a joke kind of on that same thing.
It's very harsh joke, but I follow it up.
Only date women that are very heavy sleepers, that kind of thing.
But I do that joke within the context of a larger bit that I'm talking about my wife. And as soon as I do that bit and people get a little on edge, because I talk about my wife being in a coma, which, and then I say, no, she's not in a coma. She could kick my ass at any point.
Right.
She's delivered 4 boys naturally, all of them over 9 pounds.
Right.
My wife is no sissy. My wife is badder ass than I'll ever be. And I launch into a whole thing as to why that's true. So that's the thing. You can take something out of context. If you took that one joke and you might say, oh man, that guy's really, that's pretty dark.
That's what, you know, that's another thing.
What's that?
That as being old white men, maybe you don't have this problem, but I always kind of feel there are things that I'm not allowed to talk about. Now, I don't think that you have to be part of a group to comment on a group. I don't have to be a young teenage girl to comment on people raping or abusing teenage girls. I don't have to have gone through what they went through to have a feeling and an opinion about it and a value judgment on it. So I don't agree that I have to be part of your group to comment
the thing, and I know where you're going on this, and I get it. But here's the problem. It's like black comedians can make observations, generalizations about white people that they can do in a comedy club and they would never be accused of being racist. However, as a white comic, you can't make the same sorts of humorous observations about the black community without concerns about offending them. Now, you can say that's an inequity, but it's born out of the fact that blacks are considered historically part of the underclass. These are people who are downtrodden, the poor,
right,
the destitute.
Right.
And it's not acceptable for somebody of class in the society we live in today, of a higher class, so to speak, which, and I don't like the term class. I don't like the class system very much.
Yes.
It's divisive.
I don't know how else to talk about it, though.
But you know what I'm saying.
You can't punch down.
You can't punch down. Exactly. And that's, therein lies the problem today, is this notion that fact isn't a fact, that doesn't exist. It does exist. And I know in my own career doing stand-up, I know that there are times when there's inequities. I see female comics able to do material that I can't do because it would be, from a white male perspective, it would seem chauvinistic or
inappropriate. Yeah, sure.
So it's just, the fact is...
So is there material that white men can do that other people can't do?
That's the thing. We probably are the least... We probably have the least amount of...
ammo.
I don't know if you... Yeah, I guess you could call it ammo, I guess. But at the same time, we also have a great advantage in that in our lives, we've gotten to do a lot of things that contribute to what becomes an act, what becomes a show. You know, I talk about this all the time because of my childhood. I'm one of those guys who goes against the accepted pathway for comedians. It's often said that the best comedians had horrible childhoods.
Right.
That their comedy is born out of pain. That
right.
They had either their mom was an alcoholic or their dad abandoned them when they were a kid, or there was other dysfunction in the family that's where their sense of humor came from. I'm one of these guys who grew up with two parents. My mom and dad were together until they passed. My dad was 93. My mom was 92.
Wow, they're blessed.
Yeah. They lived a long life together. I never saw them argue. And my child...
there's something strange about that.
Well,
that
may be. That may be. But you'd also have to talk to my wife and you'd discover that the very same thing is true of my wife and I. We don't argue.
You've never argued with your wife?
I can't say we've never argued, but I can tell you this. We've never gotten into any kind of scraps. I've seen... other people have knockdown dragouts. I never have had that kind of issue. Now, it wasn't just the way my mom and dad got together. It was also the fact that my dad was I didn't realize this as a kid, because you don't. Because he's your dad. You only got one dad.
Yeah, you don't realize a lot of things about your parents until you're probably over 30.
Now, you and I were talking. Both our dads served in the Second World War in the Pacific.
Yep.
My dad told me a story one time. My dad never talked about his service, or very little. as many service people don't.
Right.
Veterans are, you know, reluctant to talk about it, and I get it. But he was recovering from gallbladder surgery. I went to visit him in the hospital, and he was all drugged up, and he was talkative and unusually talkative. And
yeah.
He started talking to me about some of his experiences in the war. And it turns out that he and his platoon had gotten dropped on an island in the Pacific that had just been abandoned by the Japanese. And they had left, the Japanese had actually left an encampment on the island. And my dad and his guys were going through the encampment to make sure that there wasn't any enemy soldiers
right,
left.
Right.
My dad walked around this storage building, and about 15 feet away from him was a Japanese soldier pointing a weapon at him.
Oh.
And my dad shot and killed him. And he never talked about that before or after that had happened. And I'm sure that was something that stayed with him for his entire life, but he kept it to himself. Now, as I told you, he learned electronics when he came back from the Second
right.
World War.
Right.
Became one of the original TV repairmen
yeah.
back in the day, which is a business that I followed him into along with my older brother.
Well, it sounds like you had a great childhood.
We did. That was the thing about my dad. He worked two jobs when we were kids. I have a joke that I do in my show. I said, you know, my dad was always so pissed off when I was a kid, and I thought he was pissed off because he had to work two jobs to support us. Now I realize he was pissed off because he didn't have a third job that would have kept him away from home all the damn time. And that was the truth about dads back then. Because back in those days, dads weren't your pal. My dad wasn't trying to be
my
friend.
No, mine either. No, not at all.
It wasn't, hey, Billy, let's go out and throw the ball around in the yard. No, my dad was busy.
Yeah.
But what he did was he supplied us with a steady household. My mom didn't work, of course, as moms at that time didn't.
Right, my mom didn't work
either.
My
mom was home every day.
Yep.
We went on a vacation every summer. We used to, I talk about it in my show, every Sunday we'd get in the car and go for a drive. Didn't have any place in particular we were going. We would just end up someplace.
Yep.
And, you know, whether it was the Irish Hills or up into Port Huron or somewhere, you know, Michigan's a great place to go for a drive.
Right.
And I talk about that in my show because that stuck with me my whole entire life.
Yeah.
And
I had a lot of the same things in my family, but it wasn't so happy.
Yeah, you've told me.
Yeah, there wasn't any Sunday drives.
No,
there wasn't any vacations. You know, I went out to dinner once a year with my grandmother. I mean, we never ever went to a restaurant. We were broke. We were broke. We didn't even know how poor we were. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my parents stopped buying my clothes when I was 14. They said, we aren't going to buy anymore. You got a job, you're going to buy your own clothes from now on. Yeah. I mean, very poor. And
I think, too, though, when we were kids, too, we were rushing to grow up. I had a paper route when I was about 12, and I got it from my older brother.
Well, you know, and how do you feel about that? Now, that's gone. But yeah. I got to say, as far as a real business job, a paper route, 7 days a week, can't miss, doesn't matter, sick, doesn't matter what the weather is. I think it's a great way to break into the working world to have your own paper route and that responsibility.
Unfortunately, now my paper is thrown on my driveway by a 50-year-old man smoking a cigarette driving a Dodge conversion van from the 1980s.
Well, that's going away, too. Yeah. There's not going to be any newspaper going forward.
Of course not.
The internet has killed all that, you know?
Look, and there's the day we were expecting.
Yeah, it's sunny outside, yeah. Yeah, but I do think having a paper route was a good way for a kid to gain responsibility. And not all kids had them, just very few, because there's very few routes.
Sure.
But those kids that had paper routes were hardworking kids. You have to be, because there's no excuses. You're actually purchasing paper, and then you're paying for the paper. You have to tell them how many you want dropped off every day. Then you have to deliver them all. Then you have to go collect from those customers, and not all those customers want to pay.
Oh, God, that was the biggest problem.
I had
deadbeat customers, man.
I did, too.
They'd avoid a 12-year-old kid for 50 cents.
I know. Paper was 40, went up to 45 cents a week when I was delivering. Yeah. My paper route was more than a mile away from my house. And I had to walk down to it, deliver papers, come back. I figured I was making somewhere between 6 and 15 cents an hour and working hard from quarters. And if one guy stiffed me, because I had to pay for the papers.
Sure, yeah.
You know, you stiffed me for 45 cents at 6 cents an hour, a whole day's work's gone.
Now, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Flint.
Oh, that's right. You
proper,
said Flint.
But the neighborhood got really rough when we got into junior high, and I had an older sister. My parents wanted to kind of shelter her, so we moved out to a place called Burton.
Oh, sure, yeah.
And Burton is basically Flint with dirt roads.
It's where all the rednecks...
Well, I don't know if they're all red. But that's where... Oh, you know what? I actually had actual farmers that went to my school. The Lundy Farm was right behind our school, sure, back in the day. Yeah. Oh, yeah. But it was weird because I went from being a city kid, yeah, with, you know, 3, 4, 5 kids in every house, little street gangs, if you will, little hoodlums going out stealing stuff. We were... Yeah, kind of, sure, tough little kids, to Country Bumpkin Town out in Burton, which was, it was very weird to me. There was a dichotomy between, yeah, my culture I had grown up with until junior high, and you're pretty well set in some things by the time you get in about 8th grade, but, and what it was like out in the country. It was very weird.
Yeah. Well, see where I grew up around Ayton Gratiot. So I grew up, now,
which
8 Mile.
Which is Detroit. We're talking about Detroit.
Detroit. I was born in the city, right, and 8 Mile. I lived about 4 miles east of where Eminem grew up. Right. And I lived in, basically, it was South Warren, because I lived just north of 8 Mile. And I lived in Warren, and I went to East Detroit High School. Now, Warren, it was north of 8 Mile Road. But the southern part of Warren, yeah, where Eminem, that's where Eminem, right, was. He was in the southwestern corner of Warren. I was in the southeastern corner of Warren.
But he was there 20, 30 years later. Yeah.
For me, I was born in 57. So you're talking all through the 60s.
Yeah, yeah.
I can remember very much when the riots happened and they had sandbags piled up at 8 and Gratiot, and they had, yeah, they had Jeeps and tanks, yeah, sitting.
I remember it too.
Yeah, at the intersection.
We were hunkered down up in Flint.
Yeah, yeah. We used to see squadrons of helicopters flying overhead.
Hey, let me ask you something, and I've never asked anybody about this. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting that our parents were very patriotic. And when it came time to go to war, they understood. We had been attacked at Pearl Harbor. They were all motivated. They were all...
Sure.
On the same page. I mean, my dad went into the military. My dad went into the military the day he graduated from high school. He walked over and enlisted.
Yep, a lot of them did.
Yeah. And if you weren't in the military, if you didn't go that way, there was something wrong with you. It was really strange for somebody to, unless they had a physical ailment, and then they were, I guess, 4F or whatever they called it.
Well, yeah, but you keep in mind, though, that's the Second World War.
Yeah, but
that's
a very special
set of circumstances.
Yeah, but the point I want to get to is our generation rebelled against the status quo, rebelled against the whites-only drinking fountain. We were for civil rights. We were for women's rights. We were for gay rights. Yeah. All these things started in the late 60s to early 70s. In that time period, everybody thinks that's the 60s, but it really wasn't. It was really started about 66 and went to about 74, 75. That was really what people think of as the 60s. But there was all these environmental movements, all these things. But all of those things that we were against were our parents. Our parents were the Archie Bunkers. Our parents were the racists. Our parents were the ones that didn't think women should have equal rights. Our parents were the ones that didn't care about the environment or didn't do anything about it. Everything that we were rebelling against, we aren't rebelling against buildings or streets. We're rebelling against the status quo, the social norms. And those social norms we think are incorrect. And the people that upheld those are the same people that passed the Jim Crow laws, are the same people that we now think of as the greatest generation. And in my head, that's a misnomer. I don't think they were the greatest generation. Yes, they did some great things.
Yeah.
I mean, sacrificing yourself to save Europe, I think that's a great thing. I mean, sacrificing what you're doing for the better good of the country, saying I'm going to go work and build munitions or whatever I have to do, we're going to go on a budget. We aren't going to eat these.
Keeping in mind, though, there was a lot. Part of this has to do with the information age. One of the things that precipitated all of these great social changes is the easy access to the information. There was no internet. Well, long before the internet was conceived, I'm talking about our parents and the idea about pollution and the environment. There was ignorance there. They just didn't know any of this. I mean, people smoke cigarettes for years before they realized the danger.
Oh, yeah, I'm not faulting them for being in the moment. I'm just saying by labeling them the greatest generation, I don't know that that makes them the greatest generation. It makes them another generation that did some great things. I think the hardest thing that me and my friends ever had to do was rebel against our parents. Say, take an unpopular position. And when we started protesting Vietnam in 67 and 68, I'll tell you what, we were not treated well. And we were the outcasts. We were the minorities. When we went out to protest, we weren't the majority of the people. And every one of our parents were screaming at us at home, kicking us out of our homes because they didn't like what we were doing. They didn't like we wouldn't cut our hair. They didn't like these things. You're rebelling. You fall in line like we did. You follow what the government edict is now. And it was very, very, very difficult to fight the system.
Well, I think you're right that a lot of people dealt with it that way. I have to tell you, my own situation with my parents, it wasn't like that.
Wasn't it?
No. My dad was an interesting guy. I didn't realize this as a kid. But I realized my dad very seldom swore. If my dad swore, you know he was really steaming.
Well, that's good.
My mother never swore ever. I never heard my mom say anything.
I bet she did when she was alone with your dad. Depends on the words, Billy.
My mother is the sweetest. She was the sweetest. I wouldn't say she was a saint, but she had an innocence about her that really doesn't exist anymore. My mother, when she was in her 90s, I visited her in the nursing home down in Florida, and there was a woman at the next table was having some kind of a fit over something, and she's MFing people.
Fuck you, go fuck yourself. You can get your fucking hands off of me.
That was probably my mother.
Right? So this woman is yelling, and I glanced at her, and she goes, "What the fuck are you looking at?" And my mother looks at me and she goes, "Oh." And, you know, she's in her 90s. She's been through it all, and she's still completely
shocked. Oh my gosh. Oh my God. I can't believe that's happening.
I can't believe that woman's talking like that. What
a lovely way to go through life, though.
She was. My mom was a glass half full person.
Yeah.
Her whole life. She definitely.
Yeah, my mom was an alcoholic. She was emptying the glass.
See, my mom didn't drink. Wow. She didn't smoke.
That's a blessing.
How many
kids did she have?
Four of us.
She should have been drinking, dude. Four kids.
My mom was so sweet. Here's the thing. My brother and I, at one point, they had to go to an assisted living facility, right? So they're there. My mom and dad are together in this little tiny apartment in this senior assisted living. And my mom started to have dementia. And
oh, that's sad.
But she was very upbeat, and she just pulled me aside after they moved in there, and she goes, "Bill," she goes, "this is a great hotel." She goes, "they feed us." She goes, "and you know what?" And she goes, and like she's trying to keep it a secret, and she says, as she whispers, she goes, "and you know what? We've never gotten a bill." And I go, "Well, my brothers and I have gotten the bill, Ma." But my dad was the opposite. My dad was convinced that someone at the senior care facility was stealing their silverware and his underwear. And I'm trying to explain to him, I say, "Dad, you don't have a lot of possessions left, but the things that you do have, those things are precious. I understand that. But let me make this clear. Nobody is stealing your fucking underwear. Nobody wants your underwear. Trust me. I don't care. They might have taken a fork."
I'll tell you a true story. True story. My grandfather died, and my name is Ted Moss, and I was named after my father, who was named after his father. So the original Ted Moss was my grandfather. Now, he was a pretty smart cookie. He was director of public works for the city of Flint. But his wife, my grandmother, was one of the meanest ladies ever to live. Just a mean, mean, mean lady. And actually kind of got tickled when she really could kind of stick it to somebody. And she'd whisper about it and brag about it. Was just not a nice lady. She was devastated that my dad had married my mom, because my mom was from the wrong side of the tracks. Mm-hmm. And my mom was gorgeous, but from the wrong side of the tracks.
She was never good enough.
Well, she was kind of a status seeker. In Flint, there was what's called the top 200, the 200 families that are the upper echelon of people in Flint. And she wanted to be in that group, and my mom didn't fit in. But in any case, then I was the tainted seed of this union. So I was not her favorite.
You were Rosemary's baby.
Yes, I was the evil spawn child.
Spawn of Satan.
And so when my grandfather died.
Could you turn your eyelids inside out when you were young?
When my grandfather died, I went over to see her in hopes to get some memento, something with grandpa's initials on them that were the same as mine, some pass it down to my son, who's also named Ted, that sort of thing.
Right.
I kid you not. She went in the other room and came back with a hamity sack, which is a grocery bag, a brown grocery bag, with his undershorts in it, and handed that to me.
Nice.
Yeah, it took them
boxers off. Or briefs?
They're briefs, dude.
Oh.
And I was okay. I was poor and I was desperate and I was buying my own clothes. Swear to God, that's what she gave me. But she just delighted in that. Yeah, honestly, if you went up to, she had a cottage. If you went up to a cottage, she had a raft of books, probably 500 little novels. And if you started reading one, she'd hide it on you so you couldn't find it. She actually put poison stuff on food to make you sick to your stomach. We would go over for holidays, and she'd try and get us to eat these diarrhea-producing mints she would set out there, made to make your bowel soft or something.
Nice, perfect.
Yeah, she's a great grandma.
Sounds like
it was a wonderful life. It's funny, you grew up not far from me, about the same time. So I'm living in hell, and you've got Mother Mary raising you.
My parents were just, they were sweet. They were really.
Could I move in? Can we go back? Can I move in with you, Billy?
I wish my mom and dad were still around.
Yeah
they spent the last, they moved to Florida. My parents moved back and forth from Michigan to Florida about four or five times during their retirement years.
Yeah.
People would ask
Were they losing money every time they made the switch?
I told people they were part of a witness relocation program. There's some mob people looking for them, apparently, because they keep moving around.
They got a new name every time they come back.
That's right. We're looking for them.
All right, everybody out there in podcast land, thanks for tuning in. That's our show for the day. And I want to give a big thanks to Mr. Billy Ray Bauer for coming in the studio and having such a great conversation. Obviously, we talked for 3 hours. It's only 40 minutes. I can't hardly find anything to cut out, so he will be back with part two, even maybe part three. Who knows? But we're going to be back with Billy Ray, so tune in for that. And if you ever want to get a hold of me, you can contact me by sending an email to tedtalkstoomuch@yahoo.com. Also, go to my Instagram, tedtalkstoomuch. See all the previews with all my different comedian friends. It's a good way to pick out which show you want to listen to. But until we meet again, like I always say, be safe, be good to each other, and just try to be happy. Until next time, I'm Ted Moss, and those are my thoughts. We're out.